It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll get a preview of this week's NATO summit, which some are saying could be the most important NATO meeting since the fall of the Soviet Union.
But first, with exactly 9 weeks to go to Election Day, Wisconsin's race for governor is shaping up to be a very close contest between incumbent Scott Walker and challenger Mary Burke.
Polls are showing the two candidates neck and neck among registered voters, among likely voters, making the race one of the tightest campaigns really in the country, also one of the most closely watched.
Candidates are vying for the votes of a small and elusive group of undecided voters in a state with a serious partisan divide. So the question is, what's going to work?
Joining us now is Michael Wagner, assistant professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, a tightly contested race with a serious partisan divide. I know you study partisanship a lot. Is that... we've seen it growing since Act 10, starting a little before that even. Is this just calcifying, really, this intense divide in Wisconsin?
Yeah, a hotly contested, deeply partisan race in Wisconsin is now starting to sound like par for the course. And we're certainly seeing that calcify, as you say, here with about 9 weeks left until the election. There aren't a lot of Republicans or a lot of Democrats who are going to be changing their minds in the next few weeks. And it's the small number of people in the middle who will play an important role, as well as just whether each candidate can get their Republicans and Democrats turned out to the polls on Election Day.
Those are the two big goals. Let's take each of them in turn as far as how the candidates send their message, run their ads. And when I say candidates, I'll throw in the outside groups who are running ads as
right.
Well. First, when it comes to reaching out to that, depending on the poll, 7 to 9% of undecided voters, how do they reach out to those voters?
A heavy barrage of advertising that unfortunately everyone else has to see too, because they can't just target the people who haven't decided in terms of who sees TV ads, but also phone calls, people knocking on doors, anything and everything that they can do to try to contact voters. But mainly the traditional ways of talking to them directly at their doorstep or trying to get them in front of 5 or 6 viewings of the same ad.
And is there an understanding of who the undecided voters are or what they want? Or is this just really a potpourri of people with different reasons for not having picked a side yet?
Well, it's one of those things that's sort of peculiar about democracy, right? We have this small group of people who have the potential to be really determinative with respect to who becomes the governor. And so they're really important. And they don't care so much about politics. They aren't so informed about politics. They aren't so interested in politics. They are not the people in Wisconsin waking up asking themselves, how do I hold my government accountable today? It's the people who are just starting to now pay attention and haven't been living and dying with each Marquette law poll or anything else. And so these folks are less interested, less knowledgeable, and cluing into the race kind of at the last minute. And so it's a different set of people than those who've been talking about this race nonstop for the last several months.
Well, let's look at that other 92% now, half more or less voting on each side of this governor's race. But are we oversimplifying when we say 47% or ish are on the left and they agree carte blanche with everything that the Democrats want, and then the other half, same thing, but for Republicans? Or are they more complicated than we're giving them credit for?
The voters are more complicated than we're giving them credit for. We want to think of them as a left-right divide. Mm-hmm. Liberal Democrats on the left, conservative Republicans on the right. But there's no law that we have to organize our attitudes that way, and most of us don't. But there are issues that each individual, person cares about more than others. And they usually, when they vote, tend to vote in ways that are consistent with the party that sees it their way on that handful of really important issues. So if you're a person who might think of themselves as a conservative or maybe a moderate or somewhere in between, but you really thought Act 10 was a great idea, you're way more likely to vote for Scott Walker. But if you're that same kind of person who didn't like Act 10, Mary Burke is someone who you're going to be paying more attention to and kind of opening yourself up to persuasion from as we get closer to the election.
I don't know if there are ways to measure this, but are we starting to fall more into party lines? Like, there's nothing inherently that says if you are, against abortion, you should be against a minimum wage increase,
right,
too. But are we starting to get more and more in lockstep with what we see as right and on the left?
What's happened over the last 40 years or so is a gradual sorting on the one hand. So it used to be that there were plenty of people who said, I'm a liberal, and also said, I'm a Republican. And there were even more people who said, I'm a conservative, but I'm a Democrat. those people are virtually gone now from American politics. But they haven't been necessarily replaced by a deeply polarized electorate. Some of us are really polarized. Mm-hmm. Other folks are stuck in the middle, but in a way that doesn't give them an obvious choice about who to vote for. So some people are just honest-to-goodness moderates and don't have strong views. Other people are libertarian, so they agree with Republicans on economic issues and Democrats on social issues. And other people are populists, who agree with the Democrats on the economic issues but Republicans on the social issues. And libertarians and populists are just as polarized from each other as liberals are from conservatives. But libertarians and populists don't have a party to vote for because there isn't a party that covers the kind of the panoply of issues that they care about. And so who's a moderate is actually a really diverse group of people who aren't at all alike, which is why it's so hard to appeal to them.
Is the two-party system less representative of that diversity than it used to be? The tents used to be bigger?
The tents, you know, the tents have varied in size, I think, over time. And as new issues come into, you know, the American marketplace of ideas, who is in each tent changes. And so as one party becomes the party of civil rights and the other becomes the party of states' rights or the party of choice or the party of pro-life or the party of pro-gay rights or the party of traditional marriage, like these new issues that have popped up have changed what kinds of people want to be in each party. And for some people, it's really solidified their choice. For those people who are conservative on social issues and conservative economically, the Republican Party is a home for them, and the people who are the opposite of that find an equally comfortable home in the Democratic Party. But not everybody organizes their attitudes that way, and these are the people who split their ticket when they vote, some Republicans, some Democrats. These are people who show up less often at the ballot box and give less money to candidates.
So turning, we talk about the effort to reach out to those undecided voters. You also mentioned the need to get the people you know would vote for you if they voted to the polls. How do the candidates, how do Mary Burke and Scott Walker try to make sure that their people turn out in November?
They first start with lists of voters that are members of their party, and especially those who've supported them in the past, either financially or in some other kind of way. And they start with these lists and just start reminding them, you know, here's where you vote, here's when the election is. And then they also start finding people who are of their party who didn't vote last time, or maybe vote sometimes but not all the time. And so those are the folks who, on the ideas, tend to fit with them, but in terms of showing up on a Tuesday in November, maybe Arnold was with them. And so they try to find those people through public records who are the most likely to be on their side and might need a little nudge to show up. That's where they spend a lot of their resources, especially in the final days of a campaign.
And Democrats are the ones most worried about that turnout in an off-year, a non-presidential election, as
right.
I understand it. Is that right?
That's right. Democrats are typically hurt more in the off-year in terms of their turnout than our Republicans.
So President Obama, in his elections, his campaign was known for some new, innovative, high-tech, first cell phone and texting and social media and things like that. Are Democrats going to be able to maintain that in this off year, or on the other side, have Republicans learned lessons from that to get their people to the polls?
You know, that's a great question. So the Republican Party recognized that they were behind after the 2008 election and saw the machine the Obama campaign put together. And in 2012, the Republicans in some ways caught up to where Obama was in 2008, but then the Obama campaign took it another step, and they started running randomized experiments on undecided voters to find out, well, do voters want to hear our message, or do they want to talk to the caller about what they care about? Which of those strategies works better to convince someone to vote for me? And the Obama campaign learned that it's better to stay on message than give the person on the other end of the phone a microphone. And so they've really improve their ability to target people and figure out how to persuade them. But the Obama campaign and the Democratic Party aren't quite the same thing. And the Obama for America, the organization through which a lot of that campaign was run, hasn't shared all of their lists and all of their strategies in the same way with the Democratic Party as the party might like, which isn't to say they don't help each other. But whether state and local Democrats benefit from the Obama machine is still something that we don't know enough about. And on the Republican side, Governor Walker has a particularly adept turnout machine. And he in particular and the Republican Party in Wisconsin is very good at turning out voters, as they showed in the recall election.
We're talking with Mike Wagner of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, looking at the close race for governor. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you been closely watching this race? Are you talking about it all the time. What do you see as each campaign's individual strengths and weaknesses? How well have Mary Burke and Scott Walker branded themselves, if you're watching for that kind of thing? What do you think they have to do to win? Be the pundit here and call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We are talking about the race for governor here in Wisconsin. Labor Day has come and gone. It's the home stretch. 9 weeks from today is Election Day. And looking at what each campaign is trying to accomplish to win over the few undecided voters, to mobilize turnout, and maybe to suppress turnout on the other side. We've got Michael Wagner with us, assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And maybe we'll hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing the ads already in your area? What kind of things are you seeing? What do you make of the ads you've seen? 800-642-1234. And we just want to hear your own personal punditry. Handicap this race. What do you think is coming in the next few weeks? 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mike, I mentioned just there, suppressing voter turnout on the other side. People right. think negative ads, do they really work? Do they work?
Negative ads do some good things. I mean, first of all, hardly anyone will respond to a pollster's question about, do you like negative ads? But yes, yes, I love seeing all this stuff. But negative ads tend to teach people more about the issues in the race and tend to be more memorable and also seem to cause voters to search out more information. Hmm. And so kind of the theoretical background for that is when we're made to feel anxious, we want more information about what's going on to get rid of our anxiety, right? If you hear a rustling in the bushes, you want to see, is that a snake or a rabbit? And if it's a rabbit, you keep moving on. And if it's a snake, you got to figure out what to do. And the same sort of logic applies to how we think about negative ads. Sometimes they'll tell us things that, well, gosh, is that really true about Governor Walker? Is that really true about Mary Burke? And we might be more motivated to talk to people or check out a PolitiFact kind of website or something like that. Negative ads don't do much in terms of stopping or suppressing voter turnout. Typically, if you're motivated enough to vote, hearing bad things about the person you like isn't enough to keep you home.
So but do they really work in terms of, I was going to vote for A, but the negative advertising has convinced me to turn to candidate B?
It's possible for that to work, especially if the information environment is one-sided, which is to say, if one candidate's doing a lot of negative advertising and the other candidate isn't doing much advertising. And so if you want to look for a recent example in Wisconsin, you could think about the Tammy Baldwin-Tommy Thompson race. She was on the air very early with Tommy Thompson, he's not for you anymore. And it took a long time for Thompson to run ads. Once he did, they were negative, but Baldwin had the airwaves to herself for a while, and some think she successfully redefined a pretty popular guy in a way that helped her campaign and helped her win. So it is possible for negative ads to persuade people, but they tend to work best if they're the only people doing the talking.
Talking about the campaign for governor, and we'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Darlene on the line in Viola. Darlene, hi.
Hi there. I would like to know, why is it that we only hear about the Republicans and Democrats and the same old thing that they're always talking about? What happened to the independent party? We need a balance here. There is no balance.
Darlene, thanks for the call. We tend to talk here about the Democrats and Republicans, that they tend to get the bulk of the reporting. Why is that?
Yeah, and that's true across most of the news media more generally, except for maybe the most progressive outlets or the most conservative outlets who might talk about other kinds of minor parties. And one reason that the focus is on the Democrats and Republicans is that when Election Day comes, either Mary Burke or Scott Walker is going to win. And so, of course, the argument on the other side is, well, gee, if maybe these independent candidates could get some attention, they would have a chance to win. But most people tend to vote in a very consistent way, in a way that's consistent with their party identification. And most folks, if you press them, will pick either the Democratic or Republican Party. And the Democrats and Republicans work really hard to keep other parties off the ballot, to keep getting that media coverage, to keep maximizing their chance to win. You're more likely to win a 50-50 race than a 33% race if you're running with three candidates. And so a lot of things conspire to keep minor parties out of public attention. And, you know, it certainly isn't better for democracy that we hear less voices, but it's understandable that the attention goes to the folks who are the most likely to end up serving as governor.
Well, the economy and jobs issues have been the biggest issue, the biggest point of debate in the race so far, and the topic of most ads we've seen.
Right.
Take a listen to an ad from the Scott Walker campaign.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. Well, the latest job numbers are in, and Wisconsin created more private sector jobs than Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Ohio, and Illinois. That means we rank third in the Midwest. Our opponent can try and mislead you and criticize the Wisconsin comeback, but that doesn't change the fact that we're moving Wisconsin forward. We won't stop until everyone who wants a job can find a job.
Yeah, that's Governor Walker's ad, and now let's check out the other side, an ad on behalf of the Mary Burke campaign on job creation.
He made a pledge.
250,000 new jobs by the end of our first term in office.
And asked us to hold him to it.
Is this a campaign promise? Something you want to be held to?
Absolutely.
Today, Wisconsin is dead last in Midwest job growth. 10th out of 10.
Wisconsin lags behind most of the country when it comes to job growth.
And those 250,000 jobs, not even close. Broken promises, dead last in jobs. Scott Walker's not working for you.
Couple things I wanted to get into there, Mike. First of all, the dueling job numbers, we're going to get into this a little with PolitiFact tomorrow at this time, but each of them kind of picking a different starting point in measuring that comparative job growth.
Right. It's the rare case of two candidates for governor both telling the truth, right? So Scott Walker, his ad is accurate. Over the last 12 months, the number of jobs that have been added in Wisconsin compare very favorably to the rest of the Midwest. Now, you could back off and say Wisconsin has more people than a lot of states in the Midwest, so adding more higher numbers isn't necessarily so impressive. But if you look at it in terms of the percentage of jobs we're adding, we still do pretty well. I think it's third, as he said in his ad with numbers, but fourth in terms of overall percentage over the last year. So Governor Walker's telling, you know, a true story there. And Mary Burke is right, too. We do rank dead last in the way that they define job growth over the last several years as compared to the rest of the Midwest. The growth here has been much slower, and the recovery from the recession has been slower here than in other places. And so it depends upon when you want to start, when you think about who's doing a good job with respect to adding jobs or playing a role, at least, in adding jobs for the state of Wisconsin.
Another point I saw made, and I can't remember by whom, but when you can play the other candidate's voice in your ad, as we heard in that Burke ad there with the 250,000 job pledge, is that a particularly effective line of attack?
Well, politicians certainly seem to think so. So you can think back all the way to the 1992 race and then President George H.W. Bush's Read My Lips, No New Taxes from the 1988 race. That got a lot of attention after that promise went unkept. And so when you have a politician's words being, you know, used against them, that can be an effective tactic, because the person sitting at home can say, well, yeah, there is that politician making this argument and they didn't come through. And so maybe that, you know, can be more persuasive. The most persuasive people in ads are regular people. When they're speaking in the camera in political ads, they convince us more than anybody else.
Now, all eyes have been on Wisconsin in the last few years at various points. Act 10 and the protests that surrounded it, the recall election, swing state in the presidential elections. Is our race for governor getting a lot of national attention this time around?
It's getting a ton of national attention for a few reasons. First, if Scott Walker wins, he's vaulted into being a prime candidate for the Republican nomination for president in 2016. Whether he wants it or not, he'll be talked about much more than even already is being talked about right now. But another reason people care is that Wisconsin is a microcosm of competitive executive-level races in swing states. And that matters a lot for the presidency, as our state is almost always one of those kinds of swing states. But it matters a lot for other governor races around the country, because who wins these kinds of races not only control who gets the governor's mansion or electoral votes, but it also helps play a role in controlling who does the redistricting, drawing the lines where members of Congress and state legislators get elected too. And so there's high stakes, and our state is a lot like 10 or 12 others that all play really important roles in national elections.
Bringing it back around to where we started with the issue of increasing partisanship, does the way a race like this is run and paid for, and the issues that we talk about, the way we talk about them, does it tend to harden that partisanship even further?
Yeah, the lion's share of research about elections shows that the closer you get to election day, the more voters come home, which is to say, end up supporting the candidate from their own party. And there's a real calcification of that support for most voters as an election gets closer. Other folks might learn more information about one of the candidates, or others might break to the person they think is going to win. But for most of us, we end up returning back to the political party that brought us to the dance.
All right. Do you see that changing anytime, the partisanship in Wisconsin, anytime soon?
I think we're in a pretty contentious and divided place, and we're probably likely to stay there for the foreseeable future.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Michael Wagner. He's assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on Central Time, we'll talk to a privacy and law expert who says it's time to turn the tables on social media companies and develop a people's terms of service.
First, President Obama is trekking to Europe this week to attend the 2014 NATO summit. Since the end of the Cold War, these summits have seemingly been searching for a new purpose for the alliance. Some of the attendees haven't always been shy about voicing their displeasure about being there.
But according to our next guest, this is the year that could change things. And with Russian President Vladimir Putin's push into Ukraine, the 65-year-old NATO finally has a mission.
Joining us now is George Condon. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
So NATO founded in opposition to the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. Since the end of the Cold War, has there been kind of a question about what it's still there for?
Oh, they have spent all their summits since 1989, basically wither the Western alliance. You know, what is the future? What is the purpose? What's holding us together? And on this one, they actually don't have to answer that question. They sort of had it answered for them by Vladimir Putin.
So in absence of this this issue with Russia here, at 17 of these summits since the Berlin Wall came down, what have they talked about? What have they done? What's their mission been in absence of a mission?
Well, that's one of the things they've talked about is you sort of go back to the original meaning of the summit, which they shortened to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And they said, well, we've achieved that, so let's talk about partnerships with Russia, NATO-Russia partnerships. Let's talk about out-of-theater operations, Afghanistan being the first one outside of Europe. That's what's engaged them.
So out of theater, meaning we've got nothing to do in Europe, so what else can we do around the rest of the world?
Exactly.
So, and you mentioned partnerships with Russia. Vladimir Putin had been invited to hang out at some past summits, not this time around.
No, that's true. He's attended some. He pointedly said he had to, I think it was wash his hair when the Chicago summit was in 2012. He said he had to pick his cabinet, even though he wasn't the one picking the cabinet at the time. But this time they don't have to play games like that because they didn't want him there and they didn't invite him.
So even leading up to the summit itself, President Obama is sending a message by his travel plans, you write. He's going via Estonia. Why?
Well, because the countries, especially the NATO members, who are most nervous about what are Russian intentions are the three Baltic states and Poland. And the president already carried his message to Poland with an earlier trip, and he needs to go to the Baltic states. And in Estonia, he'll meet with the other two Baltic leaders, Lithuania and Latvia. And what they want to hear is one thing, that Article 5 is ironclad. And Article 5 is the key article in the NATO charter, which basically says an attack on one member is regarded as an attack on all.
So that means that unlike Ukraine, not a NATO member, if there is Russian military intervention of any sort on any of these NATO countries, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, for example, that's an attack on all NATO countries, and a military response would be expected from the U.S. and all the NATO partners.
Well, there's a little out there. It doesn't say you have to have a military response. It says you have to have a response. Now, it certainly, if you had Russian tanks moving and to lend, you would certainly see a military response. But imagine for a second if President George W. Bush had wanted to expand NATO to include Georgia and Ukraine. If he had had his way on that, we would have been required, and the other NATO members would have been required to respond in 2008 when Russia went into Georgia, and respond last year when Russia went into Crimea.
Well, flipping that around, though, if they were NATO members, would Russia have felt that freedom to act in the way they did in those places?
Well, that's an unanswerable question.
Sure.
What we do know is that Vladimir Putin feels really aggrieved by NATO. He blames NATO for all of his problems. I am not sure that you'd want to stake everything on a bet that he would have been dissuaded, because he really wants to restore what he sees as the glory of the Soviet Union and feels a special kinship with Ukraine, which they blame Nikita Khrushchev for basically giving away when he was head of the Soviet Union. So I wouldn't have taken that bet that he wouldn't have acted.
And Putin is aggrieved by NATO's very conscious effort to expand eastward, their drive to the east. In a way, he wasn't pleased that NATO wanted to get countries that he regarded in his, to use the 19th century term, a sphere of influence.
Exactly. I mean, he was not happy when Poland became a member. He certainly was not happy when the three Baltic states came in. There was less unhappiness about Hungary, but it was still there. I mean, they basically see NATO as an anti-Russian organization and do not like, and especially now that there's talk that Finland is considering applying for NATO. I mean, that really would drive them crazy.
Well, looking at options on the table as NATO meets this week and focuses largely on Russia and the situation in Ukraine, the latest news there, there are members of the Russian military, or at least past members, getting captured in Ukraine, Russia denying that they're actively involved in Ukraine, Ukraine saying no, they're armored units, they're infantry units of the Russian army in Ukraine. What can NATO do that hasn't already been done in terms of sanctions?
Well, number one, you can ratchet up the sanctions and make them even more painful. This is not like before 1989. I mean, Russia's economy is integrated with the West and with the rest of the world. And whereas sanctions during the Cold War probably wouldn't have had much impact, it is having an impact. If you look at the value of the ruble, or you look at the contraction of the GDP, it is hurting them. And at some point, we haven't reached that point, Putin will not want to absorb that. The second thing that they're talking about doing is what they're calling a rapid reaction force, where you would have like 4,000 troops that would be able to move on 8 hours' notice and deploy quickly into Eastern Europe. And that's something they're probably going to agree on in Wales.
Well, as things have deteriorated here, I've seen some mentions of, we're in the equivalent of a new Cold War. Is that an exaggeration, or is there something to that?
It's an exaggeration. I mean, we're not going back to a Warsaw Pact against NATO and ICP, and realistic fears of ICBM striking. But when you are dealing with two countries with nuclear forces, you do have to tread carefully. But I would not go so far as to say another Cold War. There was a lot more involved than that.
George, before I let you go, do you think there's going to be relative harmony among NATO members, relative agreement in how to deal with Russia at this meeting this week?
Well, now that one of the problems in NATO being so big now, for an alliance that operates on consensus, having 28 members, it is more difficult. They're certainly going to fight again over, our desire that all NATO members spend at least 2% of GDP on defense, because only four of the NATO members right now are meeting that. And the United States does not want to keep, bankrolling the entire alliance along with Britain. You have countries like Hungary, surprisingly, that thinks the sanctions are too strict, and then you balance that with Poland and the Baltics, who want them stronger. So I think they will come up with something, but the consensus isn't quite as easy as it used to be.
George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Glad to.
That was George Condon. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. He just wrote the piece there, "As Obama Heads to Summit, NATO Finds Renewed Purpose."
If you're a Facebook user, some of the company's actions may have rubbed you the wrong way over the past few months. From letting marketers track you around the web to experimenting on your news feeds without your consent, some users are feeling exasperated. But what if there was a way to get Facebook and other social media sites to agree to terms set by users?
Our next guest says instead of those social media sites presenting us with 30-plus pages of terms of service that we agree to, it's time to flip the equation around and develop a people's terms of service agreement that the sites would have to agree to. He says it would be a common reference point, a stamp of approval, kind of like a fair trade label for the web to govern the next photo sharing app or responsible social network.
Joining us now to talk about that idea is Woodrow Hartzog. He's an assistant professor at the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University. Woodrow, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what sorts of gains have we seen or sense that awareness is changing regarding the way people regard these current terms of service set by social media sites?
Well, the nice thing that we see is a dialogue happening when we feel like social media stepped over the boundaries, right? So we see a lot of news articles that come out and they say Facebook is monkeying with your feed, and you see a certain amount of outrage. Of course, perhaps ironically, a lot of that outrage is expressed on social media, but of course it only underscores the utility of social media and that it's a very useful place for us to go and kind of air grievances among everyone else. And so with that, we actually see a sort of consensus forming about what some norms are around what intermediaries are allowed to do on social media with the information that we're actually providing to them.
Now, right now, if you want a Facebook account, you go online, you have to click agree to their terms of service, but generally nobody reads it because there's so much of it and you probably wouldn't understand it anyway. But would you say that it's fair to say that right now it's just giving these social media sites carte blanche to cherry pick what they want to do with your data and do it?
Well, it's pretty close to that. So we know several things about this. A, you're right, nobody reads them. And it actually makes sense to not read them, because if you decided, you know, that you were going to read all of the terms of use that you encountered in any one given day, you wouldn't do anything else but read terms of use online. So you would wake up at 6 in the morning and say, all right, I got a long day of reading social media terms of use ahead of me. And so it's not rational even to expect that you read them. But the unfortunate thing is that courts actually do enforce these agreements. So when you click, I agree, then courts have pretty uniformly said that that's a binding contract. And so what we know is that, of course, these agreements are written so that intermediaries, social media, can limit risk. They draft them in favor of the social media. There are very permissive terms that allow social media to do lots of different things. And so in the instance of the Facebook experimentation feed, one thing that we saw was that there was a permission to use information contributed by users for research purposes, right? And that's a very broadly worded statement. And of course, it's in the intermediary's interest to have very broadly worded statements like that and like other things, so that it has permission, because what these terms of use function as are consent agents, right? So this is a way of getting consent to do all kinds of different things. And that's really problematic, because, of course, it runs contrary not only to expectations that we had before we even signed up, but sometimes it actually runs contrary to our experience on the website. So, for example, when you have certain representations that are made either by the design of the website, so things like use your privacy settings to control who sees your information, and somebody else actually sees that information, then that actually probably runs contrary to your legitimate expectations of things like privacy.
Now, you've got an idea for people to try to reclaim some legal power when it comes to these terms of service. You're calling it the People's Terms of Service as a starting idea. How did that idea come about?
Well, so my co-authors and I were very frustrated a little while back about the inability for users to negotiate any kinds of favorable terms when signing up for these services. So these terms are often called contracts of adhesion, and they're adhesive because, of course, you can't negotiate them. So if to try calling up Facebook and saying, Facebook, I don't really like this one term that you had in here. Is there any way that we can negotiate this? That's kind of a laughable proposition. And, of course, Facebook would say, you either take the terms as we present them or you walk away. And so we began to get frustrated because the only option it felt like users had were to say yes to whatever these companies were willing to give you. And so one of the things that we wanted to explore was a way to fight back. And we quickly began to realize that one person in isolation is not going to make much of a difference, right? So many people said, well, if you don't like using Facebook so much, then why don't you just leave? And of course, that's one way to handle the problem. But one of the big problems that we know with social media is that nobody wants to go where nobody else is, right? So you want to stay where your friends are. And so unless all of your friends simultaneously got up and decided to move to the exact same other service, then it's difficult to leave. And of course, the other option is staying remotely offline. And there are options for that, too. But social media is actually useful, and many people get a great value out of it. So one of the things we wanted to try to find was some kind of way in which users could have a say in how their information was treated and how they were to be treated when using an online tool like social media. And so one of the things that we realized is that while consumers are not necessarily powerful individually, they're immensely powerful together. And if a movement could be formed where we actually all got together and demanded some kind of adherence to a common code, right? So some kind of reference point where we could say, do you adhere to something like the People's Terms of Service? And they don't have to be complicated. They can really just be a set of five or six different very basic principles.
Right. And you say if you get this critical mass of people in the piece, you say maybe 3 million would be enough to get you going. What are some five or six starting points that people should look at to sort of start that People's Term of Service?
Sure. Well, there, of course, everyone has different preferences, which is, of course, the beauty of contracting. But we think that there are at least four or five things that most social media users could agree on. One of them is permanency, right? So if you promise me something, then you should probably keep it the same, so don't go changing the terms. One of the reasons that I think people get really frustrated and upset with social media companies is they seem to change the rules of the game midstream, right? So now you have to have certain kinds of leeway for social media to be able to change the rules, but when they do so unexpectedly and don't give you adequate notice, then that becomes really problematic. The second thing is transparency. How are these decisions being made? How does Facebook determine what is presented in our newsfeed? How do we know how our information is being used? So transparency is going to be a key component to provide meaningful notice to users. One of the things that, if you'll recall, I think it was last year or maybe a little more than a year ago, when Instagram changed their terms of service, a lot of people thought that their intellectual property rights were being infringed because there were some terms in there about the way that Instagram would use the photos and people within the photos for certain purposes. And so one of the things that we think companies should do is make a commitment to respect the value of an individual's name or likeness and the copyrights of their information. So don't take more licenses than you need to use personal information. One of the things that we think should be a bedrock protection is confidentiality. If you promise things like privacy settings and that no one else will see your information, then you really must stick to that promise. And that's something that users want, I think, more than anything. And so one of the biggest misconceptions about privacy and social media is that if you post something online, then surely you can't expect it to be private. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that there are lots of different ways that we can think about privacy, and one of them is confidentiality, that you can share information with some people but without sharing it to all people. And then the final thing, and one that I think is increasingly salient, increasingly more salient, even from when we proposed this a little while back, is data security. We think companies should promise reasonable data security measures because that's only becoming a bigger issue. And now that we've seen with some high-profile data breaches that we've had recently, data security isn't just for financial information anymore, that because we store some of our most intimate moments online, that it's also important for social media as well.
And in our last 30 seconds here, Woodrow, if people are interested in this, and even if they're pessimistic that these corporations will actually take action, what can people do to start the conversation?
People can, let their voices be heard to social media themselves, so you can write emails. There's a conversation always going. And B, use this kind of language among your friends, right? Say, if we don't like this, let's talk about this. Let's be vocal about our demands, because if we remain quiet, then nothing will change. And so just starting the conversation is the most important step at this point.
Well, Woodrow, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Woodrow Hartzog, an assistant professor at Cumberland School of Law at Samford University. We've been talking about his call for a people's terms of service for social media.